Welcome. This is the Green Majority. I am your host, Darren Kaster. Welcome to another edition. We're going to be having some really fun guests today and some really good music as well, as usual, provided by Amber Waves at Open Till Midnight blog. We're going to be talking to a very good Canadian journalist, or at least I like him anyway, Mike D'Souza, who's the national political correspondent for Post Media, who covers a lot of energy and environmental issues. We're going to be speaking to Mike in the second half of the program about some of his just recent coverage on a wide variety of issues, and talk to him a little bit about environment in the media, at least as far as his own work is concerned. But we're going to be starting the program in studio, which is always a nice change because usually I have to imagine what somebody looks like, but I am now joined as well in studio by Liz Rice. Good morning, Liz.
Good morning.
And if you want to just maybe give a little bit of a background, we're going to be talking to you mostly today about the Citizen Climate Lobby. And I have a couple very specific questions about Citizen Climate Lobby for you. But also, if you want to, just before we get into CCL, if you want to just tell the listeners a little bit about your own personal background and how you came to talking about the environment, because as your bio says, you didn't start there.
No, actually, my background was in health. And I had very poor health when I was younger. And I was always passionate about environmental issues, but I couldn't act on it. And then about 7 years ago, I got a lot better. And I decided to finally concentrate on my passions, which was health. And the environment. So what I did was I combined both those passions and started a new business, and that is Enviro Health Presentations. So I go to schools and businesses and I talk about how the environment interacts with our own health. So I was going to many environmental events to keep my education current, and I met this woman. And she started talking about this group, Citizens Climate Lobby. And I was completely impressed with her. I thought, wow, this is somebody who seems like she's really going to get something done. And I wasn't, I didn't have a major volunteer effort at the time. And I thought, this is perfect. So I got started with that. And that was over two and a half years ago now. And it's just been an amazing ride. And I'm loving it.
So not to put you on the spot too much, but I'm afraid you didn't tell me I couldn't mention this. But one of the interesting things when we were talking ahead of time, I know you've got a scared look on your face. Don't worry. I'm only teasing. No, one of the things that really interested me when we were talking before the program was that you'd mentioned that you'd been disinclined on occasion to join environment groups or citizen groups or kind of community groups in the past because you had a sense, and I don't know if maybe you can explain. I don't know if that was based on some bad experiences or so. If you want to talk a little bit about what did disinclined you to be involved with other environment groups, even though environment is an issue that's very important for you. And then after that, what specifically about CCL really spoke to you?
Right. And perfect. Okay. So what happened was I was just feeling like I'm too busy in my life and I'm not the kind of person that likes to garden. I'm not like the kind of person that would have time to do a lot of baking unless it was for myself. So I just thought, you know, how can I do something on a bigger scale? So on a macro scale, thinking big picture. That was really what I was trying to, I didn't actually have any bad experiences. I just didn't really see how I fit in. Mm-hmm. Then I could see how I could use my particular skills to further an organization that was looking at the macro picture. And there's not a lot of people that want to do that kind of work when it's easier in a way to, yes, make yourself a garden or, you know, make some cookies for a bake sale to raise funds or even fundraisers that are, you know, one fundraiser and then another fundraiser. But a coordinated effort is really what I was looking for so that every minute that I spent on something was going to really show the effect. Mm-hmm. And that's what I saw in Citizens Climate Lobby. There was a lot of structure that I saw. It started in the U.S. and Marshall Saunders is the founder. He started in 2007. And what happened was he was working in microloans in countries and disadvantaged countries to give business people there a way to start up and keep their livelihoods going. And he just realized, well, gee, I can do all this work, but with what's happening with climate change, their lifestyle is going to be decimated. Their countries are going to be decimated. So the Citizens Climate Lobby model is based on this organization called Results, and their focus is poverty issues. And so the premise of Citizens Climate Lobby is that we act on a grassroots level. We're all volunteers in Canada. There's 20 chapters in Canada. And we believe that politicians don't create political will, that it's citizens that create the political will, and then politicians do what they're asked to do. So that was something that was also different for me. I've never really heard that before.
Now, some cynical people who were here, I'm afraid, we're missing Kevin Farmer so far. I'm sure who would be jumping in at this point. But, I mean, it could be said that, yes, that's how it's supposed to work. But, you know, everybody knows that's not really how it works. Can you address that concern a little bit about, you know, if that was the model, then yes, I think citizens have a lot of power. But I think a lot of citizens feel, for justifiable reasons, very disempowered because they don't feel like that's actually how it works.
I think a lot of people don't have personal experience doing it. People think they have an impression of what it's like to deal with politicians, but they've never actually dealt with politicians. So, like, for example, I was skeptical also. I was thinking, yeah, how is this going to work? But I have seen amazing things that the members in the Toronto chapter and other chapters have done, because we hear about it. We have a monthly meeting, and it's a teleconference with all of the United States chapters and all of the Canadian chapters, and you actually hear people say, I met with this politician, and this is what happened afterwards. And it's really, CCL is all about creating relationships. So we don't go storming in and saying, hey, you're doing a terrible job. What we do is we have a laser focus, and our laser focus is on a policy that is meant to reduce carbon emissions, and it's called carbon fee and dividend. So what we do is we just introduce that to the politician, and we're working with politicians of the provincial and federal level, so we don't get involved in the municipal. That's part of our laser focus. And we just explain to them what it is. And we have an amazing opportunity this year in Canada with the NDP and the Liberal parties looking at their policies. And we feel like the more politicians that know what carbon fee and dividend is, the more likely they will enact or push for such a policy when the time comes, when the opportunity comes. So it's all about relationships. And, you know, like anything in life, the squeaky wheel gets oiled. And the squeakier you are, the more you're calling, the more you're emailing the politician, then they get to know you. And when you, for example, if there's ever some significant news that comes up, they might not know about it. I mean, they have to deal with all issues. And so we're just that conduit to say, hey, did you know about this? Or you might want to act on this. Mm-hmm. So it's been a totally different experience than what I imagined it would be, because I was also skeptical about that, and I was hesitant to go to these kinds of meetings. And this is just optional. Like, this is just one aspect of what we do in CCL, is meet with politicians. There's other aspects that we also do.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying the squeaky wheel gets the grease, in a sense, but I get the sense that it's like squeaking as opposed to silence, but also squeaking as opposed to screaming, right? Like,
that's right. We don't scream.
Banging down doors.
No.
And
it's all about forming good relationships. And the other thing we do is also try to do the same with media. We haven't had as much success, or we haven't put as much effort forward with media as we have with politicians. But one of the things that we have put a lot of effort on is letters to the editor. Again, I was very skeptical about that. I was like, you know what? I don't have time to write these letters, even though I feel like I want to, but I just never felt like I had the time. So then we got, because the structure of CCL is very supportive, so our executive director will lead sessions. Well, how do you write a good letter to the editor? Number one thing is keep it brief. A lot of people want to go on and on and on. So I learned how to do that. And so now when I have ideas, I don't just stew at home, because one of our newest members, actually, he said, well, Gia, I like CCL because instead of just complaining on Facebook, I can actually have an outlet, a constructive outlet to give my complaints. And that's how I feel about it too. It's been an amazing experience. And the other thing we try to do in CCL is always encourage people empowerment. So use your own personal power. And people always think, oh, I have no power. I'm just this little person here. But think about who you know. Whether it's we've had situations where people live on the street as a very influential person, and all they need to do is say, hey, neighbor, this is what I'm involved with. Can you help in some way? And people are amazingly open to helping, but we tend not to ask. That's a problem that people have, is they tend not to ask and they tend to think that they're little.
Can you give me a sense, just maybe based either on your personal experience or just the history of CCL, about some of the like tangible successes or frustrating failures that you really were hoping something and just weren't able to do it, or something you're really proud of, or both, hopefully, if you have both.
The good news, Darren, is off the top of my head, I can't think of any failures.
So
the successes, though, I can think of many, and I just brought in something that came up at our December monthly meeting, which blew my mind. I was like, wow, I can't believe we're this amazing. So as I said, we're 80 active CCL groups in Canada and the U.S. combined. And in 2011, we had combined 118 letters to the editor, and we track this because when we go and meet with politicians, especially our U.S. counterparts, when they go to the Capitol Hill, they actually take a book of all the photocopies of letters to the editor and say, hey, people do care about climate change, and they provide it to them in a very tangible way. So in 2011, we had 181 letters to the editor. In 2012, we had 537. And that's not just so much about the chapter growth, but it's also the individuals doing more and more. Mm-hmm. We had 500 editorials. So this would be like in the major newspaper in 22. And then meetings with MPs and MPPs, and then Congress and senators, 534 in 2012 versus 255 in 2011. So we're getting stronger and stronger and better at what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, one of the reasons, I guess it was a difficult question to ask you for a failure, is that it's, the failure simply is as if you give up, right? Because if you haven't convinced someone, you keep at it, I guess. So maybe failure is the wrong way to put it, but maybe I could rephrase that more. What I was getting at was the idea of that, like, have you had any experience where you hit a roadblock where you just had to, you realized that there was a completely change of tactic, or like maybe a particular senator or a particular politician was just not interested, and you sort of had to find a way to sidestep them. What sort of roadblocks and difficulties have you hopefully then overcome, or in the process of overcoming, but maybe something as far as someone who maybe is interested in helping with this sort of thing, but it wants to know, okay, so what do you do if they don't want to listen, or what do you do if the person isn't receptive?
Just work on it. It's all about building relationships. It's not going to be a quick fix. That's why I think a lot of other people are not attracted to doing this kind of work, because it's not fast, and sometimes it's not very tangible. That's why we try to make it as tangible as possible for people by actually counting our successes. There's been situations. I remember some of our Canadian volunteers went to the U.S. The past 2 years to do the big lobbying days in June. And there was people there that just didn't want to hear it. And then, but the thing was, from they went in 2011 and the politician didn't want to hear it, and then 2012 they were interested. So it's we've been, you know, I hear countless times on the call people will say, I was discouraged, but then this happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the beauty, and that's the inspiration. And Darren, you don't know me well, but I don't get excited very easily by anything. And I have to say, I am excited by this group. I'm really, really excited.
Oh, great. Yeah. So maybe we can move a little bit on just to some of your own work as well. So, I mean, you obviously spend a lot of time and care very much about climate citizen lobby and what you're doing there. Do you want to just let people know a little bit more about your own talks and your own business? And one of the things that was interesting in your bio, you said that you'd originally thought that you'd be more inclined to speaking to adults, but you found that you should be getting them while you're young, you said.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I'm always constantly thinking in my mind, is how can I do more to make change on a broader level for climate, in the fight against climate change. And originally, I thought, making lunch and learn presentations to adults, that's the way that I want to go with my business. And then I realized, but wait a sec, if my goal is to make as much change in attitudes as possible, as quickly as possible, then I need to go into schools. And so then I decided right early on to have schools as my focus. And that's how that decision was made. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so when we're talking schools, what age range are you looking at?
Everything from kindergarten into high school. Typically in elementary schools, I'm making assembly presentations, so it can be anywhere from 80 to 400 students. Mm-hmm. And in high schools, it's a classroom presentation, so sometimes they combine classrooms. That's what I'm going to be doing Monday. I'm going to be going to a high school and talking about healthy eating. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And you've been doing this for a little while now. Have you noticed any change over time in the sort of level of knowledge that the students already have about issues? I can give you a personal example that it was interviewing a couple high school students, and I was actually quite shocked at the level of information they already had. Can you talk a little bit, maybe just about do you notice that these students often will be quite familiar already with some of the things you want to talk about?
It really depends. I live in Toronto, so there is a big gaps in socioeconomic conditions, and that also affects the schools individually and the students. So these presentations are all customized, and I always get information about what kind of school I'm going to, because sometimes students are very knowledgeable and sometimes they're not. And obviously dealing with different age groups, so, you know, the younger kids have very little knowledge. But it's also just because you have knowledge doesn't mean you have the inspiration to make a difference, to do something about it. So I always try to definitely end every presentation on a positive note and give students as much tangible things that they can do, and show them even other young people that have been very successful in doing something and how they did it. So I try to weave all those things into it. Yeah.
Do you find that's hard at all? I mean, whether you're dealing with children or with adults, that's one of the kind of struggles that we deal with constantly on this program as well. I generally deal with it by being very sarcastic, but how do you try and end conversations about climate change on a positive note? Because that's a challenge unto itself.
Well, human psychology is very complicated, but you have to give people something that they can do. And that is, you can think big picture and you can act big picture, but ultimately it's like a muscle. So if you're trying to get strong, you're trying to build up your muscle, and the students have to do the same thing. Making little changes and realizing the impact of the little changes eventually leads to big changes. So... yeah, it's all about inspiration and just starting the students to do something, and that leads to other things. I mean, that's how I got involved in CCL in the first place. You know, I didn't. It was a process, and what I'd like to encourage people to do is just jump in, and you're going to have fun. You're going to be amazed at what you're going to do, and you know, 10, 20 years from now, and someone says, well, what were you doing about climate change? Or when your grandchildren or your children ask you, you can say, well, this is what I was doing.
Now, one of the things that there was two things when I was having another look at the CCL website this morning. One that was that I noticed was that you had a clip of Dr. James Hansen, who's one of my favorites, and we were very fortunate to be able to interview him a couple of years ago, actually. And the other one was for a film called Chasing Ice. And I wasn't sure if you wanted to maybe save that for another time, or if you wanted to say a few words about that today. But just about why what that film was and why you'd chosen to put it front and center on the website.
Yeah, well, we chose to put it front and center because so many of our members have seen it and they were so impacted by it. But what they said is there's nothing at the end. It doesn't tell you what you can do. So it leaves you kind of just hanging, this amazingly impactful film, but it leaves you hanging. So and we decided that, hey, why don't we use this as an opportunity? So in CCL, we're constantly being creative. We're constantly thinking, how can we do something? What can somebody do? And a lot of it is just up to us. What do you want to do? So this is something that I kind of also took on for the Toronto area, and our Canadian manager's taking it up for the Sudbury area. So what we're trying to do is talk after screenings of Chasing Ice and actually tell people about CCL and how they can actually make a change. And so that's what we're using. This is our first time really using a documentary as a springboard to both get new members and to get people into the audience that normally wouldn't be there.
Mm-hmm. And just to give a background on it as well, this was a documentary was filming a lot of the basically the breaking up of the Arctic and the melting of sea ice and some of the, but I mean, which sort of sounds, you can say that it rolls easily off the tongue without getting any sense of its impact at all. But this is really stunning photography and videography that's taking shocking images, really. I mean, I'd find it off the cuff to find it hard to say that watching ice melt was shocking, but it really is quite shocking.
Well, yeah, and the photographer who's profiled in the film, National Geographic photographer, he actually said that 20 years ago he was one of the deniers, not feeling like climate change was a real thing. And now he's basically risking literally life and limb to go take pictures of it because he understands how impactful those photos are. And one of the examples, I just saw it actually last night. I was speaking at a screening, and he said, you know, he actually showed in 100 years this glacier retreated, so melted, 8 miles. In the last 10 years, it did the same. So 100 years compared to 10 years. So it's visually showing the proof, and he has spoken, to many audiences and shown them this, and this is very impactful. So that's why CCL has latched onto this as another means to spread the message.
Absolutely. So I'm afraid we're running out of time, Liz, but I want to thank you so much for joining us today. So maybe we'll recommend this. We'll put a link up to the Chasing Ice preview, and then when people are wondering what they can do because they're so terrified after they've seen it, how do they contact you to join CCL?
Right. So they can go to our website, citizens.climatelobby.ca, and then they can link to other sites and like the American site. So that's the best way. And also, if you really don't have time to volunteer, please consider donating. We do want to send more volunteers to Ottawa this summer to do lobbying, and that would be an extreme help.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Liz.
Thanks.
All right. So we're going to take a music break, and we'll be right back with some more fun, where, as I said, we're going to be talking to Mike D'Souza, who's a very well-accredited national political correspondent for Post Media, who specializes in energy and environment. Later in the program, we're also going to see if we can find Kevin Farmer for you as well, so stay tuned.
That I give myself to breathe. Everything's so crowded, there's no room for me to fall apart. In between the trying not to smash my fist on broken thoughts. Dreams, they wake me, shake me, take me to a place where I can't sleep. In between the trying, let me feel so much time. I'm all tied up with wondering what it means to be alive. In between the sofa, scratching nails on chalkboard walls of time. Classroom clock ticks slowly backwards. Playground shape to fill my shakes them, takes them, breaks them, casts us all, they fall around. Paper napkin memories, fine tissue, marker, thing that speaks when swollen, and neatly, gently, sweetly, cast aside their own form now. In between the trying, blindly, fiercely, not to die. I'm all tied up with wondering what it means to be alive. In between the surface, scratching nails on chalkboard walls of time. Classroom clock ticks slowly backwards. Playground shape to fill my mind. Paper napkin memories crumbled, carefully just strewn above. The window shakes and takes and breaks and casts us how they float around. Paper napkin memories, one tissue from the thing that speaks and told and neatly checked and sweetly casts us how they float around. Spoken words that echo bliss. You reach out to pull me in to push us out of this abyss. In between the torn up, tear up, break up, break down fits. I know it's not good enough. I need so much more than this. More than takes them, breaks them, casts us out.
All right, and you are back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority, Canada's all-environmental news hour. We're broadcasting on at least 18 stations coast to coast, from Vancouver, BC to St. John's, Newfoundland. You can also find us on our website, which is greenmajority.ca. You can also send us an email, either through the website or through thegreenmajority@gmail.com. We've been getting lots of people responding to our posts recently, which I love. People sending me emails, giving me questions, which I also love. I do my very, very best to answer all of them. I also love it when people send us content. We had some people send us some really neat videos from some Fox affiliates, actually, which, believe it or not, was actually worth watching. all sorts of great stuff. So interactivity is all the name of the game these days. We love it when you interact with us. Send us something on Twitter if you like. We're at Green Majority. You can send us something through the Facebook. You can send us something through the website. Keep in mind as well that I spend about 4 hours after each show uploading in the audio, but also being very detailed in the post as well. So if there's anything that we're mentioning today, like anything with our first guest, Liz Rice there, we're talking about Citizen Climate Lobby. We're going to have links to all that material up on. We're going to have links to the video that we were talking about. We're going to have links to all the news stories that we're talking about today. So pretty much everything. So if you missed it, or if you came in, if you're listening live on the radio and you kind of came in halfway through something, not entirely sure what we were talking about, or you want to be able to go and read the article for yourself, please do go check out the website. I spend quite a bit of time putting it all up there just for you guys. So go ahead and use it. That would be great. I believe we do have Kevin on the line, though. Kevin, are you there?
Hi, Darren.
Good morning. Nice to see you so virtually today. What was striking your desk this morning? What was on the news desk?
Well, a few things. I think the one that still has me thinking about it was an article in The Guardian regarding the loss of wild pollinators in a study conducted in something like 600 different fields in several different countries. I believe it was actually on different continents. They measured the impact of wild pollinators on crops and came to the conclusion that what you might call domesticated pollination, where we bring in honeybees and set up shop, you know, trucks carrying dozens and dozens and dozens of hives will set up shop beside a field and let the bees go and do their job.
A $1 billion industry, I should add as well. That's a very, very big business, is beekeepers for commercial agriculture.
Exactly. Yeah. So we have this kind of domestic pollination, but they found that it just doesn't compare to wild pollination, and that wild pollinators are at least twice as effective at pollinating as domestic honeybees, and we're losing these wild pollinators, of course, because every species on Earth is going extinct. And we're losing wild pollinators at quite an alarming rate due to loss of habitat. And, you know, we don't, you know, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. It's just an issue that we don't think about. Like the collapse of domestic beehives has received a lot of media attention in recent years. But there hasn't been very much attention paid to wild pollinators. And of course, if we lose them, then we agriculture will never recover. Mm-hmm. We depend on pollinators of every stripe for something like 3/4 of our food supply, and it would be pretty safe to say a civilization altering event if we were to lose severely impair wild pollination of plants and
absolutely
crops.
Well, something I was reading, and you're talking about pollinators just in general, like the whole kind of natural system, but specifically staying with bees, of course, there was a lot of concern around, you know, mysterious illness. I forget what they had actually figured out it was. I don't know if you know off the top of your head, Kevin, but they eventually, after like 2 years of people panicking about this mysterious bee death syndrome that was kind of going around the country, they sort of figured out what it was. But there was, because of that, there was a lot of talk about sort of like people actually realizing how desperately. The entire food system relies on bees to produce it. And some numbers started floating around. And again, I'm sorry, I don't have the exact figure in front of me here, but just the idea of something about, you know, the cost of food, if you had to, if you couldn't rely on something like a honeybee, domestic or wild, either way, and had to do it, say, for instance, manually, like you can manually cross-pollinate plants and, you know, someone can go down and kind of wave their arms around little brushes. Like there's actually equipment to go and do it. But the price of food would literally go up by an order of magnitude. So like $10 worth of rice would suddenly become $100.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, manual pollination would be fabulously inefficient.
Yeah.
And you know, this is a service that we get for free, essentially, from Mother Nature, and we don't place a value when we look at the loss of habitat. We don't factor in the cost of, you know, say pollination for crops. Like we don't factor in how much we're impacting the local insect population, and what that means is a dollar value to food production, which is, you know, not to say that I look at this as an accounting issue, but often it's the only way to get any traction with these issues.
Yeah.
Like I believe habitat should be left intact because I believe it should be left intact, and that nature should be allowed to exist in its wild form and be left undisturbed.
Yeah, it's one of the things I've found as well, just in sort of speaking to people about this, and this, or I mean just about any other issue, is that some people won't sort of understand the gravity or connect with the issue if you don't dollar and cents it, if you don't put it onto a balance sheet for them, you know, and say, well, nature's great, but I like my job. You say, no, well, okay, well, these bees produce $10 billion in commercial, you know, activity in Canada and you know, has a 3% of it, whatever, you know, putting in that terms. And they're like, oh, wait, all of a sudden I love honeybees. And,
yeah.
and then other people the other way around will be like, well, I don't think pricing nature is, you know, valid, and how, you know, these numbers are arbitrary, and be like, okay, well, how about, you know, just in a general sense, we just shouldn't be killing everything in sight. Right, so it's sometimes a balance of those two things, or some people only respond to sort of one of those two arguments, and I think it's good to be informed about the sort of things like we're talking about, like, you know, the approximate increase in cost it would be if we had to do this on our own, but it's hardly the actual argument.
Yeah, it isn't the argument for me and, you know, people like me, but like you say, it's the only thing people will pay attention to, and this is how issues often get any traction at all, is when you put a dollar value on them. So, which is an interesting discussion in you know, the environmental movement about putting a price on nature and whether you know, making nature a private commodity will protect its interests better than making it an unprotected public good, but that's a slightly different discussion.
Well, I think we'll have to leave it there. We'll come back, Kevin. We'll call you a little bit later in the program. We're gonna move on to Mike D'Souza for now, but we'll come back and get through another headline or two a little bit closer to the top of the hour. So we'll speak to you then. Thanks so much for joining us. We're going to go now to Mike D'Souza, who is the national political correspondent for Post Media News, who focuses primarily on energy and environmental issues. Are you there, Mike?
Yes. Hi, how are you?
Hi. Thank you so much for joining the Green Majority today.
Yeah.
So
thanks for having me.
The reason I wanted to have you on was one, I'm just a big fan of your articles. They cross my desk on a regular basis. One, because you focus on environment and energy issues, but also just because I think you do a really good job at it. We're a big fan over here. One was just to maybe go through some of the recent things that you've been writing about. But before we get into the specific articles, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, as an environmental journalist, you know, you do yours professionally. I do mine on sort of my free time when I can. So I don't sort of have the resources to pay as close attention to what's going on as I'm sure you do, which is why, you know, we have to rely on yours and others' work to look at some of this stuff. So my sense is that you're probably a little bit closer to it. I mean, a lot of the times you actually get to go and do these interviews with politicians, or you get to see, to get to actually have the ability to file things like Freedom of Information Acts and get access to this information. So based on your personal experience over the last year, we've seen a lot of things happen around, say, for instance, the Keystone XL pipeline has brought up a lot of issues around Canadian-American relations as well. We've had a lot of Canadians going down to Washington to protest. We were speaking to some of the people who went down to take part in those protests. There seems to be a lot of cross-border allegiances being made in the way that we haven't really seen that in the past. But having been following this, I know that you also are pretty good at paying attention to the political angle on these, because a lot of the time the focus is political. If you could just speak a little bit about what you've noticed in from your own coverage of what you've been doing over the past like 6 months to a year, just about where how the conversation is actually happening, because I find it's very difficult to sort of get a sense when you're just sort of sporadically reading articles here and there, but about where the actual power lies, because one of the things we were talking about on the program before is how traditionally Canada sort of takes a lot of its policy cues from the U.S., but one of these issues that have come up during Keystone and other things has been that the Canadian government was actually trying to put pressure on the U.S. because they were concerned that the U.S. wasn't sure about that. So can you give me, sorry, that was rather a long introduction, but based on think something using maybe Keystone as an example, can you talk a little bit about, from what you've been covering, just about what the actual status of sort of Canada-U.S. environment relations are around things like Keystone?
So, I'm not sure I grasp your question. You're asking about what...
I apologize. I think I shifted focus there about halfway through when I was talking. So basically what I mean is that like we've had a lot of stuff around Canadian and U.S. relations and Canadian government, for instance, making it public that they were concerned that the Americans weren't going to go through with things like Keystone. Mm-hmm. What I'm wondering was what your impression was about that relationship between the Canadian and American government, who actually sort of has the public, who actually has the power in that situation, and do you think that the Canadian government is going to be successful in lobbying the Americans to get something like Keystone through? Like, do they actually have the political pull to get something like this to actually happen?
I don't know. In terms of the discussions on that, I mean, there's evidence of effort by diplomats, by industry stakeholders and lobbyists, through advertising, through public opinion. There's all sorts of different factors that are part of this debate. I think the U.S. officials have been clear, that they are following a process, where the regulator is, the State Department is reviewing this matter at the bureaucratic level. Ultimately, there could be a political decision, and I think, it is certainly telling that there have been all these delays, and the industry stakeholders and Canadian government officials certainly weren't expecting this process to drag out that long, and that's why it is a bit unpredictable at this point what will happen. And I can't predict, and I don't have any insight into what's going on inside the Obama administration and State Department. But these delays are certainly a sign that there is concern. The response from having the Alberta government go down there repeatedly, including in the past week, is a sign that there's concern from the Alberta government, and there are also Canadian diplomatic missions from the ministers in the federal government right now that are going down. They're also concerned Keystone Pipeline might not be approved. So these are all factors that we can use to sort of predict what will happen, but until a final decision comes down, I can't predict for certain what will happen.
One of the things you outlined in your most recent article was that during a CTV interview, Peter Kent had said something about he had expected journalists to convey the good news that basically that some of the studies showing drops in levels of pollutants with relations to things like energy and tar sands projects and stuff like that. Do you feel like have you ever felt as a professional journalist like you've been under any pressure from government to sort of string along a certain story with them? Are they sort of like asking you to tell it their way, or have you ever felt like they're sort of like, here's what you should be saying?
They don't tell us what to write, but, you know, certainly, I think it might be common to all governments, they do get frustrated if they have a specific message they want to get out and they don't feel it's getting out. Any government, and that's, you know, been my experience, over the past 10-15 years, you will see a government get frustrated if it doesn't feel it has good news about its policies in the media. There are certain cases where they get so frustrated that they lose it sometimes, and they probably cross lines. They say things publicly or do things publicly, deliver certain messages, write some controversial letters to the editor that go a bit beyond what we'd expect a democratic government to do. We do have a free press in Canada, fortunately. So I do feel totally free to cover the news and do my job.
Well, we do, as you said there with a bit of a chuckle, that we do have a free press. But in all seriousness, one of the issues that we've covered on this program many times before is, for instance, it's certainly not the only example, but not being able to speak to Canadian government scientists, for instance, without going through some sort of PR person or PR approval. Can you comment at all about your personal experience about trying to get information about your stories, about the environment, from government sources?
Yeah, it is difficult, and I have said this in other interviews, and I've said it in the blog and in public comments I've posted on Twitter, that it is always a challenge to get answers in a timely fashion on certain issues with this government, issues like climate change, issues like the oil sands. These issues do automatically set off alarm bells. I've spoken to people who work at the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade who have told me any time I mention oil sands in any requests, it does set off alarm bells all across. They follow this very closely and they're very sensitive about it. So when it comes to the scientists, there are cases, and I've written about some lately. I've written about some in recent months. Some of my colleagues have as well. We get scientific studies, we get evidence, and if we want to get a comment from the scientists about what this means, it takes a while. It can take a day. It can take a few days. Sometimes there are studies that are conducted, and the government doesn't make any active effort to promote the work that its own researchers in various federal departments that are funded by taxpayers. They don't make any efforts to promote these studies. There were cases, recent monitoring efforts in the oil sands where there was peer-reviewed research that was out there, but we didn't know about it until we found out about it through access to information requests. So, you can interpret that as whatever way you want to interpret it, but it does seem a bit unusual that we have to do access to information requests to get access to the work of government scientists.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the kind of my point of view is that the Canadian government is there to regulate and sort of run Canada. And as taxpayers, they're public servants. I mean, it's not sort of essentially, they literally are the public servants. So it seems very mysterious to me that it's even possible for them to sort of redirect or make it very difficult to find things that essentially we've paid for research to be done. It's not like this is issues of national security. It's not like these are information about proprietary technologies or anything like that. I mean, it's just research that essentially Canadian citizens paid for, and then depending on whether or not the government likes what it says, they may or may not let us look at it. It seems difficult for me to even understand how that's even legal for them to do that. I mean, maybe that could just be my naivete about Canadian law, but can you speak at all about, like, is this something that that you think will eventually go away? Is this something that you think is is just kind of here to stay, this kind of new paradigm in Canada where we're allowed to see what we either fight really, really, really hard tooth and claw to eventually get a look at eventually after filling out, you know, making 40 phone calls and filling out 15 forms, or is this sort of something that you think will pass at some point?
Yeah, I don't know. It depends on how the public feels about it. And, if the public feels this is an important issue and, let the government know that might be something that could change the situation. But it's not completely unusual. It's happened in other governments. It was commonly reported on during the Bush administration. And I think even in Canada prior to the current government, there were concerns raised in the past about, the scientific research that was being done on cod fish stocks, in Atlantic Canada, and there was criticism after the fact about a failure of the government at the time to respond to warnings from scientists and use the scientific research to shape policy. There are certain differences and certain examples that do seem a bit different now. Mm-hmm. But I suppose there's always been a bit of a pattern on a lot of these issues, and it's really if the public has a concern about it or is aware about it, that can make a difference here. But I don't necessarily see a lot of signs yet that the public is totally aware. But, mm-hmm.
Have you found in your experience? I don't have the resources to go out and do a lot of primary research. So in a lot of senses, we rely on journalists such as yourselves to do this. Do you find like it's an impediment to your doing your job? Like it just makes it take longer and it's a little bit more work, or do you feel like it has ever actually prevented you from doing your job?
The difficulty
in getting access to information because of the sort of new PR people that's for instance Environment Canada information has to go through. Have you ever felt like it's actually prevented you from getting the information you needed to do a story?
As opposed to it just taking an extra week. The facts, I suppose, speak for themselves on this. There are many cases where it has taken several days to get answers, like in the past week a story about what the government was telling First Nations and what it was telling industry stakeholders prior to the omnibus budget bill last year that changed a lot of the country's environmental laws. There were differences in what they told the First Nations versus what they told industry groups, and it took them about 8 days, I think, to provide an answer. I had to write the story in the meantime.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote the story, I think, after 4 days of waiting, and we got the story out there. Sometimes we do feel obligated to wait if we feel it's important to get some kind of context, at least from the government. And it is a concern when it can take that long for them to provide answers. But we proceed, and often there are stories where there are unanswered questions, but I think, that's something that's probably, is not totally unusual in journalism. When you cover news stories, you get some information periodically, or perhaps not using the right expression or the right words, but what I mean to say is you follow stories and they develop through time and different elements emerge through time. So, it's up to us as reporters to continue pursuing stories to get new answers, to find out more every day.
Absolutely. Well, I think, one of the ways in which some of the policies in which we were talking about obviously prevents is it makes it more difficult. And it means that your average citizen doesn't either can't or doesn't really have the time or is disincentivized from you know, making an inquiry of the government and that sort of thing. And I think that's what's so important about journalists and specifically what you're doing and exactly is that, you know, your job is to not let that dissuade you, right? And to keep making those phone calls. And if it wasn't for that, then we really wouldn't have a lot to talk about on this program because I certainly don't have the time to go and do all that stuff. So that was my roundabout way of thanking you very much for specializing on energy and the environment because I think there should be a lot more headlines focusing on those issues.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, so we'll talk to you again another time, but for now, thank you so much for joining us. Mike D'Souza, who's national political correspondent at Post Media News, focusing, as I just said, on energy and environment. Thanks so much for talking to us today.
Okay, thank you.
All right, take care.
Bye.
So we've got only about 5 minutes left. Kevin, I think, are you back on the line, Kevin?
I certainly am.
All right, so I thought maybe we'd just sneak in one more headline there before the end of the day. Was there one other thing that was grabbing your ire today before we run out of time?
Well, let's see. There's a few things. I guess the one that is maybe the most topical at the moment is that another article in The Guardian, a study was released, a survey was released recently that spanned several countries, and it found that public concern for the environment is the lowest it's been in 20 years. And what caught my eye, I mean, aside from being alarmed by that discovery, what struck me was their conclusion, or at least an inference that they made from the data. It wasn't really their conclusion, but the comment from the researchers was that people are sensing the failure of government to tackle these issues and their general apathy on the environment, and so they're starting to sort of tune it out. And I thought, well, I wonder how they came to that conclusion, but that's an interesting thought. If it's true, does government apathy on the environment influence public opinion? And I've always thought about it the other way around, collective apathy in the voting public on environmental issues. That,
yeah. Well, I think, it's kind of a perfect one to have picked right after we just talked to Mike D'Souza, he was saying, again, it's his job, he focuses, he's not just a journalist, but he specifically focuses on energy and the environment, so it's sort of his job to stick it out and to keep searching for information until finally, you know, somebody gets back to him and gives him an answer, but by making it so difficult to get information, you're sort of choking out or diluting the amount of environmental coverage that could possibly be in your sort of daily dose of soundbite news, because there's only so much information to give, right? And or it's, you know, by dragging or taking, you know, by the time that you hear about something, maybe it's two weeks ago, and now it's the Oscars, and someone's distracted, and yeah, and I think that's sort of why that issue about access to information and how difficult it can be to get answers from our own government about stuff that they're spending our money on. And again, not like it's like secret military technology or something. It's like reports on water quality and stuff like that. I think is offensive, really, because it's our money. It's information we should have access to. But by sort of making people jump through a whole bunch of hoops to get access to it, you're essentially able to dilute it into the rest of the news cycle, so that you've heard 14 stories about Paris Hilton's shoes before there's some, and, you know, Great Lakes water is terrible. But now coming up the Super Bowl, and I just, I feel like that's a lot of, I think that's probably how that back and forth works of sort of government influencing, public awareness on these issues, just simply by choking off a lot of the best information. So we could talk about the same story over and over again, but there's only kind of one story. There's only so much we can say about it. So it limits how much coverage we can possibly do.
Right. And that's an interesting way of looking at it. And if that's true, if that's correct, that sort of access to information from government sources or the lack thereof is quieting down the public discourse on the environment, then certainly our government, the Canadian government, the Harper regime is extremely guilty of squelching information from scientists and putting them and on environmental news in general. It's been every single minister of the environment has been nothing but an apologist for his policies, and has in no way been a steward of the environment or even an environmentalist of any stripe. And the money that this government has taken out of research and the effort they've gone into muzzling scientists and forcing them to vet all of their press releases and speeches to the PMO they've waged a real war on sort of access to information, and like you say, this is all government funded research. Not only should we be aware of what it is, we have a right to know what research is discovering, but it should be informing policy. It should be a threat to Harper sees independent investigation as a threat to his preconceived notions. Oh, just like the Oscars, they're playing me off.
Yeah, no, that's I'm afraid that is all the time we have for today. But I want to thank you very much for phoning in and always making yourself available no matter what. Kevin Farmer as well. And thank you very much to our guests, of course, today as well, Mike D'Souza and Liz Rice. That is all the time we have for you, right, Kevin? So we'll have to talk to you again next week. But I'm Darren Kaster. You've been listening to The Green Majority. Please check out greenmajority.ca for more information. We have posts about all the articles, all the links, all the groups we talk about, absolutely everything on the website. We'll talk to you next week.